Hi, and thanks for having me. I'm Deke Arndt. Like Jan told me to go no longer than 3 hours. So during the week, I'm your employee, but I'm not speaking today as your employee or even really as a scientist, but as your neighbor, about climate change, which often gets reduced to a political issue or even an environmental issue, when in fact it's an issue. And people of faith and people of fellowship and people of conscience and any combination of those are beginning to align kind of their spiritual approach to the reality of what's going on there. So very briefly, as she said, I study climate. I work with a group of wonderful people that keep score for the climate system. Last week, we announced that 2014 was the warmest year on record for the planet, since we've been keeping records in the late 1800s and by a fairly comfortable margin. But really, no one was ever found dead under a trace of globally averaged temperature. It's what it does to the weather, what it does locally, that means the most. So I was admonished to not be nerdy, so I will try not to speak like a scientist, but just share, you know, one of the joys of my career so far has been to work with people around the world that are, first of all, wonderful scientists, but almost more importantly, relating what's going on in the world around them. Part of that State of the Climate series, we have people that submit data and analyses to us in spite of literally civil war around them. And we ask them, you know, how do you do this? You're not getting paid. You're in danger. And they see what is going on in the parts of the world that are subject to that kind of uprising. And much of it is climate related, and it's important to them to share. So hopefully I can represent their voices here as well. Like I said, nobody was really ever found dead under a trace of globally average temperature. But some of the things that affects our extreme heat around the world. And if I were speaking as a scientist, we would talk about bell curves and probabilities, and now we're getting more extreme heat waves and fewer extreme cold waves. But when we get extreme heat, the poor suffer. It happens in the United States. One of the clearest climate signals in the United States is that morning temperatures in summer are warming more rapidly even than afternoon temperatures. And while that may not sound like much, a morning low of 80 is a lot less sexy than an afternoon high of 105. When you don't have air conditioning, and that morning of low stresses your system, it is a public health economic concern. It is a personal concern. The folks without air conditioning, the folks that work on roofs at sunrise that typically don't have adequate health care are subject to that. Plants and animals, livestock, horticulture, agriculture, also sensitive to that. But that's just temperature. One of the other issues that we see a lot from our contributions around the world, you know, about almost 1 billion people are dependent on glacier water as their source of drinking water and their usable water. Glaciers are retreating. The average glacier of the 30 glaciers that the community tracks since the mid-1980s has lost an average of 40 feet. And that's not off the end. That's off the top. So the average glacier around the world has lost the equivalent of ice as a 40-foot slab taken off the top. People depend on these for their water in Asia and in South America and to a small extent in East Africa as well. And it's not just out there. The melting of frozen stuff is important in our own country. We are currently in the process of relocating the first dozen or so of about 200 Inuit villages in Alaska that were built on top of permafrost that is no longer perma or frost. It is thawing, and the infrastructure on which these villages are built are suffering the consequences. And then also, if these are coastal communities, the wave action from the seas, now that it's striking against a thawed soil rather than a frozen soil, is literally eating away at these villages. From a cold economic standpoint, it costs about $100 million to move a Native village. We all kind of bear that cost. From a personal standpoint, if someone were to ask, let's pick up Hendersonville and leave it, I'm sorry, I know your grandfather is buried here. You cannot live here anymore. That's the consequences that many of these Native villages are facing. Sea level rise is also associated, and if I were speaking as a scientist, we would talk about how the warming of the ocean expands the waters and the melting of the glaciers contributes to sea level rise. But what it means here in America is nuisance flooding is the term for it, blue sky flooding, which is happening increasingly in Charleston, Savannah, Annapolis, Chesapeake Bay. Go ask any business owner on the Atlantic coast if they have more high tide flooding, king floods, than they used to, king tide floods, and they'll say yes. And so they bear the cost of that, and to some extent we collectively bear the cost of that, that kind of flooding. If you take that to Bangladesh, as you know, hundreds of thousands of subsistence farmers have been growing crops to basically feed their family and get along the coasts of Bangladesh. Due to sea level rise, not only has that ground been taken from them slowly, but the salt water that intrudes basically makes it non-viable agricultural land. And the options that parents have that are trying to feed their children due to subsistence farming in Bangladesh are pretty bleak. Usually the option to exercise is their children are sold into servitude and they work further inland, hopefully as bricklayers or in a factory, but in cases sometimes some unspeakable situations. And that's where people of faith and people of fellowship and people of community, as we come together, whatever our congregations, we're here in these halls and we meet on a regular basis to ask things like, why are we here? How do we relate to each other? What should we be doing about big things? Who speaks for those who can't speak for themselves? Bangladeshi subsistence farmers are not contributing to a warming world, but they are suffering the consequences of that. And just one more example of what's going on. As a scientist, I may speak about an increased hydrologic cycle, which sounds like gobbledygook and kind of is, but it basically means that for most of the world, the rainy parts are getting rainier and the desert parts are getting drier. And even over the oceans, the salty parts are getting saltier and the fresher parts are getting fresher. And we could have a slideshow with many slides with graphs on them showing this. But what that means in the world, in my home state of Oklahoma, we recently literally pulled the plug on Canton Lake to basically meet the water needs of Oklahoma City. Canton Lake, like any other flood control lake, not that big of a lake, but by pulling the plug on Canton Lake to meet the thirsty needs of Oklahoma City, Canton, Oklahoma just got a death sentence. So the recreational community that was built around that lake will be gone. And that's an economic damage, and it's rough for the people that are there. But another way that that increased hydrological cycle, the droughts getting droughtier, play out, are in the Near East. The last few years have been some of the driest on record in modern history in much of the Middle East and Near East. One of the consequences of that was Turkey, the nation, basically shut off the Euphrates River as it flows into Syria and Iraq. And when the Euphrates River stops flowing into Syria in 2012, lots of Syrian farmers and young men have nowhere to turn. They face a pretty horrible government as it was, and they turn to revolution. And unintended consequences of that kind of revolution led to some of the groups that we see over there today, which certainly aren't Syrian farm boys, but are made up of some of those. So we are connected. We are connected to those kinds of populations in the world. Some of the things that we talk about that get thrown around as a political football, that get thrown around as a green issue, are very human issues. And that is the totality of kind of what we face. And finally, recognizing again that this all sounds very bleak, but we are people of faith, people of fellowship, or people of conscience, or some combination of that. And as we ask ourselves, as we go forward, what can we do? Hopefully the thinking people can provide some influence as a small community, as a large community. So some of the things that we talk about in a nerdy way in science are adaptation and mitigation. Adaptation is exactly what it sounds like, dealing with the consequences of change. And that may be on the Atlantic coast of the United States, building seawalls that basically buy us another few decades, which is a completely viable and rational and logical thing to do. It may be helping the poor get out of places that are doomed. That is adaptation. It may be dealing with the consequences of greater heat. That's adaptation. You can do that on a local scale. You can do that on a large scale. We also talk about something called mitigation, which is essentially taking action to slow down or stop the rate of change that we see around the world. And you can do that on an individual scale, and it's usually energy efficiency type things, you know, using energy efficient tools and appliances. You can do that in a local way, and although an individual's effort is really small compared to the magnitude of the problem, it is important. If you feel the urge, individual contributions help. Individual contributions help slow down climate change the same way that handing someone a sandwich addresses world hunger. Yes, it is small, but it makes a difference. And we can take action as communities, as neighbors. I'm thrilled and proud of a congregation that I'm in that is trying to take their facility to a carbon neutral setting through the use of solar panels. These are the kinds of actions among neighbors that have a cost. And not only will that congregation save money in the process, economically it makes good sense. They can reinvest those savings into the actions of the community that congregation finds valuable. And then there's larger actions it can take as well. And then finally, you know, this is bleak. Some of it sounds hopeless. It is not. I'll reflect back, and thank you for reminding me that I'm an Oklahoman, because this just dawned on me. I grew up in Oklahoma. I practiced in Oklahoma for 15 years. And one of the most, the biggest thing that has happened in modern Oklahoma history is the Dust Bowl. And it left a scar on our state that is still a scar. And it completely changed Oklahoma's view of itself and its role in the world. And in many ways, they're still getting over it. It was a big deal, and it was environmental change. It was short-term climate change. It was some of the things that we're seeing elsewhere in the world when the rain stopped and the practices were ignorant compared to today, and the economy was against the folks and their education was against themselves. All of those came together to make a really pretty horrible situation in the 30s in Oklahoma. And there were novels written about that. But there weren't novels written about the 1950s. And which technically, according to the data, you look at the rainfall and the temperature data, was a worse drought than was experienced in the 1930s. And the lesson there is the sons and daughters of the people that went through the Dust Bowl in the 1930s learned in the course of one generation how to deal with the climate system. They made it through what should have been a worse drought because they had education, they had a healthier economic system, they were more in touch with the modern economy, they had help, and they had knowledge. And it's one of the great unwritten novels in the case. But I share that kind of at the last minute because there are things we can do. If you were to put yourself in an Oklahoma farmer's perspective in 1934, it looked like the end of the world. If you put yourself in that farmer's daughter or son's shoes in 1954, they were coping with it because there was a lot of effort, a lot of community support, and a lot of understanding to go around. And much of that came from communities of faith, communities of fellowship, and communities of conscience. A lot of the tricks of the trade were literally shared at Sunday church services. How do you make a pound of flour go another couple weeks? How do I fix my tractor? Who's growing the best kind of wheat? That's where they came from. So communities like this are empowered in many ways. And in helping with the climate change issue, I think you're definitely empowered. And if you would think about it and feel the need to act on it, please do. All right. And thank you for your time.